Capital Region, this is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we take a break from our regular program to bring you a talk by Dr. Max Libiron, our headlining speaker at the Sanctuary for Independent Media's Rural Ecologies 2 conference. First, we'll hear Nature Lab Director Kathy High introducing.
Rural Ecologies 2 virtual conference builds upon a 2018 Rural Ecologies Grounds for Change conference, which brought together leaders in art, science, and environmental justice to explore the history and future of urban environments shaped by stress. Rural, from the Latin rutus, meaning rubble, refers to plant species that are the first to repopulate disturbed lands, an apt analogy for the state of our post-industrial neighborhoods. It is through this lens that we envision our futures. So Rural Ecologies 2 brings together cutting-edge artists, scientists, social science scholars, and activists working beyond the barriers of any one discipline. Because this is a virtual conference, it's possible to present thinkers and host audiences from around the world. Reflecting our commitment to curate a feminist framework into this conference, the majority of our speakers are women or gender nonconforming. We have also invited Indigenous authors, scientists, artists, and speakers with the intention of embedding a variety of Indigenous ways of thinking, storytelling, and expression into conversations about our future. So without further ado, I would really like to introduce our speaker tonight, who is Dr. Max Libiron. Dr. Max Libiron is a leader in both developing and promoting anti-colonial research methods into a wide array of disciplines and spaces. As founder of CLEAR, an interdisciplinary plastic pollution laboratory whose methods foreground humility and good land relations, Libiron has influenced national policy on both plastics and Indigenous research, invented technologies and protocols for community monitoring of plastics, and led the development of the interdisciplinary field of discard studies. Libiron's book, Pollution is Colonialism, bridges science technology studies, STS, Indigenous studies, and discard studies, while providing a framework for understanding all research methods as practices that align with or against colonialism. Focusing on plastic pollution, the text models an anti-colonial scientific practice associated with Métis concepts of land, ethics, and relations, and demonstrates that anti-colonial science is not only possible, but it is currently being practiced. One reviewer for the book wrote that the text is, quote, at the leading edge of a significant turn in STS towards thinking with settler colonialism as a structure and terrain that contributes significantly, as well as to thinking about how ethical principles relate to lab science and studies of pollution and shorelines. There are exceedingly few texts of this kind that ask, how might we consider relations with land, waters, and science, and still practice good science, unquote. Dr. Libiron is an associate professor in geography and is formerly the associate vice president of Indigenous research at Memorial University. After Dr. Libiron gives their presentation, we will have a discussion led by Drs. Abby Kinshi and Guy Schaefer. We welcome you, Dr. Max Libiron, and thank you for being here with us tonight. Everyone, give a big round of applause.
Tanji, Kea, thank you for that introduction. Max Libiron, de Shinakashun, la Glouish du Chien, Nikia Metineshun. So I'm speaking to you tonight from the capital city of Newfoundland and Labrador, St. John's. And those are the homelands of the Beothuk. And the larger province of Newfoundland and Labrador are the homelands of the Mi'kmaq, the Innu, and the Inuit. So the thing about land acknowledgements is that they are less good now that they're super common, which is not exactly what we expected. A few weeks ago, I was putting together a panel for the Society for Social Studies of Science Conference 4S, and I put together a land acknowledgement, and I shared it on Twitter. And I used the best practices of doing land acknowledgements, including from like my cousins who live in Toronto, which is where the land acknowledgement was from. And a lot of people liked it and retweeted it and hooray'd it. And then a smaller number of people really, really, really hated it. And half of those people were trolls of the white supremacist variety. Although fascinatingly, some of their trolling was like, what, you think white people are gonna give back their cottages? And I was like, oh, you understand land back. You're a very enlightened troll, that's good. And some of it wasn't. But then the other half of the pushback came from Indigenous folks and some allies that I actually think are legit allies. And a lot of folks are really tired of land acknowledgement standing in for good land relations. They're tired of them standing in and pretending to do the work of anti-colonialism and certainly decolonization. And a lot of them were saying like, this, we're not doing them anymore and you shouldn't either. So the reason I bring this up is because part of my jam is working in really fraught spaces. And so land acknowledgements are now that, so that's great. But when I talk about fraught terrains, what I'm gonna talk about tonight and what a lot of my work is premised on is when there's no clear path, when your accountabilities are split and your obligations are split. And so in those sorts of terrains, for me at least, the primary research question is how? How do you maneuver them? It's a methodological question. And I would consider myself primarily a methodologist. And the question of how is both a methods question and an ethics question simultaneously. And I think you can intuit that from like, oh, well, what the heck do I do about land acknowledgements now? And what I've chosen for this moment, which is this is the first land acknowledgement I've been involved in since that kerfuffle on Twitter. So maybe Twitter was one part of the issue too, is just sort of explain that they are not quite so awesome all the time, or not ubiquitously, or not completely, or monolithically. So the premise of my work and this talk and my book, and if you ever have an academic chat with me, is that methodology is a way of being in the world and not just doing in the world. So all methods, all doings, whether they're artistic or scientific or cleaning your house or whatever, enact land relations and are part of land relations simultaneously. They can be colonial land relations, they can be anti-colonial land relations, but method is just another way to say land relations. And that's great, but the problem becomes, okay, what if those land relations are both colonial and anti-colonial, like simultaneously? And so that's sort of where I'm going to land today. And I'm sort of choosing this topic, which is a topic that I haven't written about explicitly before, although I think it's pretty latent and sometimes not so latent in my work. And in my book, but I'm talking about this because I think it really fits the topic of ruderal. Anyway, the ecologies that start with R that this symposium is about. Ruin-based ecologies, right? Things that happen after purity and grand scales and utopias are like off the table. And that's really great because we can just start the conversation further along, which is nice. And so the question, methodological question of how becomes, how do you work on the ground you stand on with all of the shitty inheritances that ruination and colonialism and all these sorts of things bring? So I'm going to talk through three examples tonight. The first is environmentalism, the second is care, and the third is life. So like super light topics. And in each case, I'm going to talk about how they're fraught terrains and this idea of what I call incommensurate goods or incompatible ideas of what is good. And each example, the goods will get more and more fraught and the terrain will get less and less clear for navigation and things will get trickier and trickier. And there is no, by the way, resolution at the end of the talk, but there is like a pretty well-defined hot mess or described hot mess. So I'll be talking quite a bit about the book that I've recently, well, I haven't recently written it. I've been writing it for over a decade, but that's recently been released to the public. Pollution is Colonialism. Oops, this way. It's like the weather person. Everything's backwards and also nothing is actually truly there. So I can't, I can't check. So Pollution is Colonialism is with Duke Press. It's a short-ish book, and a lot of the ideas I'll be talking about have some seeds in there. And also, if you've started looking at this book at all, you'll know that I'm a really big fan of footnotes and citations in particular being on the page. So you can literally see whose shoulders I stand on and whom I'm launching with and in conversations with. And so I tried to do that for this talk, but it's real hard to get footnotes in Zoom. The person is always on the bottom because of gravity, so that's fine. So throughout the talk, there'll be head notes. And at the end, I'll provide a bibliography as well in the chat. So that's what that's all about. So let's start with an easy, fraught terrain, or easy to me because I've already written the book and edited it at least a million times. So I'm going to talk about two particular land relations that have different and usually incommensurate ideas of what is good, and that's environmentalism and anti-colonialism. This is straight out of the book. I talk about colonialism as more than just the intent or identities or heritages or values of settlers and their ancestors. Instead, colonialism is a way to describe relationships that are characterized by conquest and genocide, which are two of the techniques that grant colonial and settler access to indigenous land for settler and colonial goals. So this is the bumper sticker sort of working boundaries of when I say colonialism, what I specifically mean. Now, this isn't a universal definition of colonialism. There's lots of different colonialisms around the world, lots of different land relations, but this one works really well for settler colonialism and the type of colonialism that is in what is lately called North America. Yeah, so the focus on land, the little orange land there, it's not just dirts and bees and trees. It also refers to indigenous ideas and concepts and life and knowledge and all our relations. And so that means the focus on land doesn't always mean, in colonialism, doesn't always mean accessing, you know, dirt to make private property for settlement, although it does totally mean that too. It can also mean like using indigenous you know, designs or symbols in art. It can mean access to indigenous land for scientific research or materials for art or something like this. It can mean imagining a clean and healthy and pollution-free future and working towards that by doing beach cleanups on indigenous land without permission or consent from those indigenous people. And so when I talk about non-indigenous goals, desires, and futures, I include ones that are benevolent. And that's why it's really important to talk about environmentalism. So there are some scholars who talk about what I'm about to talk about very, very well and very, very in depth. Dina Gillow-Whitaker, who's Colville Confederated Tribes, and Kyle White, who's Potawatomi, both talk about at length how environmentalism is not only not the opposite of colonialism, but environmentalism usually doesn't even address colonialism and very often reproduces it. So they talk about how environmental solutions like hydroelectric dams or consumer responsibility or appeals to the commons or composting or whatever, they all assume access to indigenous land and its ability to produce value for settler and colonial futures and the stabilization of those futures, which means environmentalism propagates and maintains the dispossession of indigenous people for the common good of everyone else. Now, this doesn't mean environmentalism is necessarily bad. This is, you know, mostly mainstream environmentalism. But the reason I'm bringing this up is not to like poop on environmentalism, but to point out that this is a very clear example of where there are different and incommensurate ideas of what is good. And you can be meeting some goods while also doing colonialism. And a really good text for thinking through this is Tuck and Yang's Decolonization is Not a Metaphor, which for many of us is like a keystone text. And in this work, Tuck and Yang talk about how decolonization in settler-occupied territory in Canada and the United States means land back. That's the fullest of what it means. So that means environmental things that are not land back are not decolonial. It means inclusion is not land back, so it's not decolonial. And one of the main arguments that they make is when you start conflating different goods like inclusion and anti-racism and taking your shoes off at the front door with with colonialism or decolonization, then things like making diverse syllabi are suddenly supposed to be decolonization, but they don't actually change land relations. And because it seems like something's been dealt with, people move on to the next problem, which is the critique that people have about indigenous people have with land acknowledgements going mainstream as well. So if the goods are conflated, so are the bads, and so are the interventions, basically. So these are the stakes of articulating different goods, right? Especially when they're incommensurate. They actually are integral to doing the type of changes that I think we generally want to do. So that was example one, environmentalism. Example two, I'm going to talk about care for a bit and science. So dominant science, which is a flavor of Western science, is pretty colonial, sexist, racist, elitist, macho, exclusive, individualist, masterful, extractive. It believes in binaries like male, female, nature, culture, life, death. It believes in objectivities. And a lot of these ideas have become really unexceptional norms through everyday practices. And they just get reproduced kind of easily and effortlessly in dominant science. And I know this because I am a dominant scientist. I'm a scientist in the tradition of dominant science, right? So I have a lab coat. It's part of my day job. I have microscopes and scales and pipettes and stuff like that. And so the question for me as a scientist is not how will science care for me, but how do I care for science? Because as a scientist, that's part of my domain. That's part of my obligations. So as a scientist, how do I care for a science that tends to be colonial, sexist, racist, elitist, macho, exclusive, and blah, 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 right? And what's interesting is that even though I studied a lot of science and technology studies, I do not have a good answer for that because I haven't, in that practice, I didn't care for science. I used to exclusively critique it, especially as a graduate student. But when I came here to Newfoundland and Labrador, there was a lot of what's called undone science. So there was a lot of things we didn't know about pollution here because they hadn't been studied in a scientific register. And a lot of that was needed, that sort of research needed to do different type of political change. And so I started doing science. And that's a little bit awkward, right? If you're an Indigenous person in dominant science that's super colonial, that's a little awkward. So there are a couple of theories or concepts that have really helped me in this work. One of them is Charles Hale's concept of compromise. So Charles Hale is a white guy who works with Indigenous folks sometimes. And he talks about how if you are trying to change a system or work within a system that you've already identified as screwed up, you are going to reproduce parts of that system while you also change that system. And when we say there's no outside of the system, that's what we mean, right? And then also in Takin Yang, there's this great part it's like three or four lines, and I wish it was a book, but they talk about an ethic of incommensurability, which is an ethic that recognizes differences without conflating them, hence the like not conflating decolonization and like, I don't know, brushing your teeth three times a day, different types of good, but with also without smoothing them over or dichotomizing or abandoning them, right? Keeping them in complex and ongoing relationships as an ethic. And so these two ideas and others are really helpful because they are against purity politics, right? They're against the idea of doing action on a clean slate. And one of the issues I often encounter, especially with students that I'm encountering right now in my classes, but also popular in some expert discourse around the sort of around action, is this idea that your intentions and your actions can be devoid of compromise or contamination or the man or the system or whatever. But that's terra nullis. That's the colonizer's dream, this idea of an unblemished, hasn't been touched before playing field. You don't get to choose the ground you stand on. And often it's kind of crappy. And that crappiness is the basis of your collaboration with the world, right? You don't get to be outside of land relations. So I keep this in mind when I think about caring for science as a scientist, how to care for sexist, colonial, racist, science. And Kim Tallbear talks about sort of coming to this realization as well in this piece called Standing With and Speaking as Faith, which is a really great piece where she talks about how, again, she comes up through her graduate degree, learning exclusively critique and not really care for her research subject. And she's, even though she learns about it technically in books and in seminar, and she starts her career researching white settler genomicists who are doing this really violent act of equating indigeneity with DNA, which is not how most Indigenous folks, or I don't know if any, there's not a single Indigenous nation, according to experts on this, like Desi Rodriguez Lone Bear, who use DNA in any way to talk about tribal belonging or citizenship. It's purely a sort of settler weirdness. But she says that as she's doing this research, she comes to realize that she's, in her own bad words, a bad feminist because she's not caring for her research subject. And so she has to figure out how she's going to do research so she can stand with her research subjects. And so what she does is she switches to working with and studying Indigenous genomicists and what they're up to. And so just like her, I don't care for or stand with the entire spectrum of dominant science, because sciences aren't a monolith. There's no purity, not only for activism against systems, but also for those dominant systems. There's no purity for colonial or dominant science projects either. There are many sciences even within Western and dominant science. And someone who's helped me think about this is La Pepperson, or who's also Wayne Yang. And he talks about this in terms of a third university. So a decolonizing university, as opposed to a decolonial noun university. He talks about, regardless of its colonial structure, right, and its origins, because the university is full of moving parts and machines and techniques and legacies, it's not a monolith. And so its machinery is always available to being subverted to decolonizing purposes, right? And so that means we have a theory of change that has to account for, we need a theory of change that accounts for the permeability of the apparatuses of power, right? And the fact that even neocolonial dominant systems inadvertently support multiple decolonial agendas because they aren't monoliths, and giving them that sort of power means that your only theory of change would be throwing your soft body against a solid brick wall until you turn into a pulp. And that's a really poor theory of change. So one of the ways I think about caring for science, but also the complexities and the fraughtness of caring for science, is one of the things our lab CLEAR, the lab's name is CLEAR. One of the things we do in CLEAR is we work on finding anti-colonial methods that basically interrupt this situation. So we don't always do land back. We rarely do land back, but we can certainly stop the entitled access to land in different ways, like say only going where we're invited by Indigenous folks, for instance. But another thing we do is we publish and make very accessible all of our research methodologies with the intent that Indigenous governments and Indigenous communities who don't have a ton of grants and don't have fancy laboratories, although my lab isn't fancy, but it doesn't even have laboratories, can also do the type of research that we're doing so that they can compare it and get the kind of data that the settler state might demand of them. And so that in one way is caring for and through science, but at the same time, it's reproducing parts of the system we're trying to change, including continuing to hold up forms of evidence that the settler state privileges. So, and that's an easy example. I was gonna give harder examples, but this is being recorded and some of them aren't legal. So we're gonna skip that. Or it's in the gray area, and I want to keep doing some stuff that's all I'm going to say about that. So one of the things I think about when I think about caring for dominant science as a scientist, it really helps me understand that care is about entanglements on uneven terrain that reproduce that uneven terrain, and it's not a benevolent good, and that's the full story. And we know that there's readings like or texts like Murphy's Unsettling Care that talks about some of the colonial underpinnings of care work, right, and this sort of thing. So there's some folks to think through the issue with. All right, so the last example I'm going to talk about in terms of maneuvering incommensurate goods in therefore fraught terrain is about life, death, and disposal. So one of the main types of research we do in my lab is we research Inuit food webs, mostly Inuit food webs, also settler food webs, wild human food webs that depend on wild food, although our main work is with Nunatsiavut government. So we'll get animal guts and we'll look in them for plastics to sort of see where plastics are in human food webs and wild food webs. So what happens is hunters and fishers, when they hunt and fish, they'll get animals, they'll send us the animal guts, we'll look in them for plastics, which means that by the end of a study, we have a whole lot of animal guts. And they can't be eaten because at this point they're very, very freezer burnt. There are some animal guts you can eat. And they're also done being scienced. And so university protocol, because they're organic tissues, would normally be that you incinerate them. But we've gotten permission from the biohazardous committee to return them to the land if they're not toxic. So that's what we do. We call it gut renaturation. And we base that practice on Indigenous protocol, because both in Métis and in some Inuit protocols, that is what you do with guts, and you do them in very similar ways. But when we return the guts to the land, we have a lot of settler folks and non-Indigenous folks, other non-Indigenous folks in the lab. So they don't have those traditions, but it's very similar to, say, composting, which a lot of them will do, or ecological nutrient circulation. We've got a lot of scientists and ecologists in the lab. So it makes sense in those registers. And so it looks like when we're doing this, that we're all doing the same thing, but I would argue that we're actually doing very different things. So how different people in the lab are understanding these animal guts, I think, are fundamentally different. And I'd like to introduce you to Vanessa Watts and her really awesome piece on Indigenous place thought, where she talks about how there's a colonial way of understanding the world that removes the how and the why out of the what. So objects get evacuated of their hows and whys. And so what's left are these objects that are ready for human interpretation, inscription, et cetera. And the reason this is important is when even in the most caring and loving descriptions, things like dirt or other parts of the world are acknowledged in what STS would call an actant, right? So something that is enlivened but not actually alive. And it's no longer an afterthought, like these objects, this in her case, she's talking about dirt. It's no longer an afterthought. It gets brought into human relations in a very big way, but it's still a human relation, right? So questions are about how the dirt affects me or how do I affect the dirt? And that means that the agency of the dirt is limited to sort of a human-centric set of relations. And even if it's a loving relationship or a caring relationship, the concept of an actant is still quite reduced. And this type of dirt, she says, is not first woman. So for Vanessa Watts, who's Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe, and for many other Indigenous cosmologies, although I don't think Métis, actually, things like dirt and rocks and trees and air and animals are alive. They make decisions. They're making judgments. They're passing their judgments on, they're making memories, they're passing those memories on through generations. And that is not what an actant is. It's something different. So I see this example play out a little bit in the lab. So when different lab members are taking animal guts and getting them ready to bring back to the land, at the end of their analysis of them, they have to go back in the freezer before we take them out to the land. Because we take them all out in big bunches and you want hundreds of guts frozen when you do that. Otherwise, it's really, really smelly. So what they'll do is some students will or lab members will carefully put the guts into bags. They'll make sure everything's gathered up, absolutely everything, put it in the bag carefully and then pop them back into the freezer. Other students kind of look like they're doing the same thing, but you can see that they fold up the guts like they're dressing them. They move them into the bag. They escort them to the freezer. And these subtle differences sort of indicate the lab members that treat them like an actant, something to be respected, but something with an essence, but not life. While the second set are treating them like relatives that are alive, even though they're animal guts, right? And so while in the lab, I can talk about respecting guts in death, a lot for people who don't believe that they're alive, I can never bring about those two sets of lab members And actually, I'd say there's probably more than two sets, but I can never bring those into alignment. And this doesn't mean, and this thing I'm talking about does not mean and cannot mean that everyone has to understand rocks and dirt and guts as alive, as things that make decisions, or how to be good kin with rocks, or any of these sorts of ideas that come out of various indigenous ontologies and cosmologies. And that is good, because first of all, not only is it impossible, it's also not good if you start conflating those things or start trying to resolve those things. So there's a few reasons we don't want various indigenous concepts of life or kin or cosmologies to become universal or fully understood by a variety of folks. First is because there's no such thing as an indigenous concept or indigenous cosmology. Pan-indigenous cosmologies don't exist, right? So like I said, Métis folks, as far as I know, dirt isn't alive. Although now that I say that, I'm pretty sure we have grandfather rocks, so I might be wrong and I need to check. But still, they're not universal, right? So there's no such thing as an indigenous cosmology or an indigenous approach to kin or an indigenous approach to life or something like that. It doesn't exist. Secondly, there is no method outside of white possession that would ever allow someone who's not indigenous to fully take on indigenous cosmologies and ontologies, right? And going back to our working definition of colonialism, access to indigenous concepts and cosmologies of land to enrich non-indigenous goals, futures, research pursuits, relationships with the world is a form of colonialism, and this gets said a lot. Third, there's this really great book by Jennifer Nash called Black Feminism Reimagined that's all about what happens when the ideas from the mainstreams or the margins go mainstream. So in her case, she's talking about intersectionality. She says when intersectionality goes mainstream in feminism and women and gender study, what happens is it's there to enrich white feminism. It's like a corrective for white feminism to fix some of its tendencies. And because it's there as a corrective, it ends up in a permanent service position, right? Secondly, what happens with that is that Black feminists are in a constant position to do what she calls defensive work, right? So correcting how intersectionality is used or not used properly, or people are like, I have beautiful intersectional jewelry. And they're like, that kind of work, right? Which is exactly the kind of work I did at the start of this talk when I said, okay, let's work on what decolonization is and isn't, which I am having to do in every presentation I give, because currently you can like decolonize your kitchen sink as long as your plumber smudges or something like this, right? And it leaves those colonial land relations intact. Yeah, I highly recommend this book. It is very good. Fourth, the other reason we don't want to just sort of use indigenous cosmologies is that we know from standpoint theory and regimes of imperceptibility and all of these ideas from feminist STS that the diversity of ontologies are a good thing. And the problem is when one way becomes dominant or mainstream, because that is always to the exclusion of other things. So those are all the reasons. Yeah, that I don't want everyone in the lab to understand guts as kin or as relatives or as alive. So while there might be overlap in certain areas, like it all looks like we're doing the same thing when we're putting guts back into the land, onto the land, there are certain parts of that that are not only not totally understood across all the lab members, but some of them don't ally or align as well, and they can cause conflict or harm. Right? But sometimes they often do overlap. So this is where standing with gets tricky or even impossible, because at the same time, you're still called into an ethics of care. And so this is when I really think about, again, Tuck and Yang and their ethic of incommensurability that recognizes what is distinct, what cannot be joined or conflated. And they say that this ethic is a way that brings these areas into conversation without papering over differences, but also without maintaining false dichotomies. So having the like indigenous, non-indigenous as a hard line is also not in our best interests. So this sort of mess of incommensurate goods and not dichotomizing incommensurabilities is, I think, the tricky methodological and ethical question of feminist and anti-colonial sciences, art, research, methodology in general. because it nuances what compromise means. It no longer is just the reproduction of the bad when you're trying to do good, but it's also about the reproduction of different and incommensurable goods that can do violence through mutually exclusive goodnesses, but also don't all the time. So the question is, how do you work with these in every instance? So that's my current sort of research question, what I'm left with. These are the sorts of questions of where I am right now. Maybe you are also in that kind of space. I think these kinds of questions are quite characteristic of doing change work in dominant spaces, which means, and I think a lot of the people here are interested in that kind of change work. So I look forward to our conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Max. Wow. Quite impressive. And also really gave me a lot to think about. So I really appreciate that. I'm going to be chewing on this talk for a while. And we have two really wonderful colleagues of mine who are going to help us jumpstart the conversation. The first person is Dr. Abby Kinchy, who's a sociologist whose research and teaching focus on environmental challenges and the relationship between science and democracy. She lives in Troy, New York, where she is a professor in the Department of Science and Technology Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Kinchy has written two books that explore how ordinary people use citizen science to examine environmental problems and advocate for solutions. Science by the People, Participation, Power, and the Politics of Environmental Knowledge, co-authored with Aya Kimura, and Seeds, Science, and Struggle, the Global Politics of Transgenic Crops. Kinchy also led the Watershed Knowledge Mapping Project, a study of volunteer watershed monitoring projects in Pennsylvania and New York, where concerned citizens aim to use water quality data to protect their streams from the impact of natural gas development. I'd also like to mention that Abby has been working with us at Nature Lab on another project called Our Soil that uses DIY practices and citizen science to look for heavy metals such as lead, arsenic, and copper in our urban soils. So that's been an ongoing project. We really love that one. The other responder discussant person is Guy Schaefer. Dr. Guy Schaefer, and Guy is a lecturer in the Department of Science and Technology Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute as well. In his teaching, Guy creates space for aspiring STEM professionals to investigate their relationships with the human and more than human world, and to imagine approaches to science and engineering that can build more just and sustainable futures. Guy has worked for 7 years with BK Rot, a nonprofit compost hauler in Brooklyn, New York, built around the principles of environmental justice, and currently serves on their board of directors. He's written about BK Rot and other community compost projects in his dissertation, which he's currently working into a book manuscript. So thank you both, Abby and Guy, for joining us. I will turn it all over to you. And thanks again, Max.
Thank you, Kathy, so much. And thanks, Max, for a really amazing talk. That was great. I don't want to take up a lot of time today sharing my own comments because I think there's, you know, people are here to listen to what Max has to say. And so I guess I wanted to start by just drawing out one of the themes of your talk that I really connected with and wanted to hear more about. And that was when you used the phrase caring for science. And I think there's just so much to talk about there, particularly, you know, as someone coming, you know, out of science and technology studies, which, as you say, is often about critique of science, and then, you know, sort of now becoming part of the world of dominant science itself and figuring out how to practice that. And I think that, I mean, Kathy and I can talk about this as well from our own experiences working in this new project of Nature Lab, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, and trying to create new ways of doing science with community. And I just really appreciated what you said about describing caring for science as doing or using anti-colonial methods that interrupt science's entitled access to land. And I wondered if I could just give you some space to expand on that idea a little bit more about how the kind of scientific work that you do is interrupting this entitlement to land that has been so built into dominant scientific practice. That's one of the things that I especially love about your book that I think you could also expand on a little bit more here about how pollution itself is colonialism, right? It relies on this expectation that land will always be there as a sink for, you know, the stuff that we're throwing out. And I guess extending from that, I'm giving you now too many things to talk about. I wonder if you could share any experiences, maybe from the early days of starting up your lab, that those of us who are also trying to kind of begin that sort of journey, coming from STS and from arts and other places to do scientific research about the land that we live on. What are some of the questions that we might want to be asking ourselves at the outset? Particularly if we're really committed to this idea of forming anti-colonial research practices. So I guess those are a whole bunch of things, and you could jump in with whatever you'd like to respond to.
Yeah, the shortest version of an answer would be like, oh, thank God I wrote a book about that. So you can just read the book because it's really late here. And I don't think I can, that's not already still not all in my head. Half of it's fallen out. So feel free to ping me again, Abby, for whatever I forget. I'm going to start with the last part, mostly because it's what I remember. Starting a lab, there were a series of realizations coming out of STS that helped me understand what STS fundamentally did not prepare me for. And that is, when I came here, I was ready to critique the science on plastic pollution because that was my bag. And there wasn't any. I mean, there's a number of political reasons for that. But I had no way of thinking about how having science to critique in the first place is actually an immense privilege and a luxury. And that the problem of undone science is not just like this weird inclusion model and not just like a handy justice model. It's like the freaking thing for a lot of places. And so I was like, oh, well, okay, I guess I'll do science because I also have science training. I actually dropped out of science and went into art, then dropped out of art and went into STS and then dropped out of STS apparently. Well, I'm still kind of there, but now I do science again. I was like, well, thank goodness I know feminist STS. So I guess I just won't do science like that. But then there was zero answer for me for how to do science because all I had was critique. And I was like, okay, so I don't do this and I don't do this and I don't do that and I don't do that and I don't do that. Well, what the fuck do I do? Right. And so that's part of why a huge part of our lab is dedicated to all of this documentation to be like, here's how we do it. Here's the do. Like that we tried and it's not perfect and it's not whatever, but like we didn't have a roadmap. So we're just trying to like leaflet the path so that people can pick things up after us and sort of run with it. As Murphy has reminded me, like documentation is a feminist practice for these exact reasons. So the movements coming behind you don't have to reinvent the wheels. You've already tried, right? So I realized that I did actually have a set of skills for helping me do science differently. And that was the work I'd done in social movements. So Occupy Wall Street and all these other sorts of things that were always less defined than Occupy Wall Street, ACT UP, these sorts of things as well. And also like how I was brought up. And that's that you start with values and everything you do is supposed to be an enactment of that value and what we would call original instructions, but other people can just be like, walk the talk or talk the what? No, you know that expression I'm trying to say that, like just do what you say you're going to do and do it the whole way. So if you say your number one value is equity, you better not have a whole bunch of white guys saying that, right? You better like everything you do, how you take out the trash, who's taking out the trash, what's in the trash to begin with, how you ordered the stuff that became trash, all of that better be about equity all the way down, turtles all the way down, right? As Thomas King would say. And so it started very simply like, okay, well, how am I going to, and it started with feminism as opposed to indigenous STS, because that's what's available to me. So like, okay, how do I not be macho, which doesn't mean don't be femi, although that is an alternative, but like, how do I deal with gender well in this? And it's not just the inclusion model. It's like, also like every moment, right? So, you know, so yeah, so that's how we started the lab. And the other thing about caring for science, like, I love science. It's exciting. I love looking in microscopes. I love building things that plug in and go beep. I don't love doing statistics, but I love the graphs that statistics make. And there's, so, you know, and I like figuring something out that you can't do unless you do statistics on it, because you just can't see certain things with your eyeballs and stats see very different things. So like, it's not hard to love that. And I don't think we should feel guilty about it. So in science spaces, people are like, oh yeah, I love it. But in STS, they're like, you love that fool, that abusive boyfriend? You're like, well, not all men, not all science. Like, what do I say to that? Like, yeah. So I don't think it's a coincidence that I've come back to science as a principal investigator, as a professor, because then I have more capacity to actually care for science and do science differently than I would have as a graduate student or a technician or something like this. Is that good at what you're... Does that start to get at things, Abby?
Yeah, it really did. It was great. So I'm going to hand it over to Guy now, and then I think I'll come back and have another question.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Abby. And thanks so much, Max. This was amazing. And I've been like so happy to get an excuse to just like immerse myself in like every podcast you've recorded in the last year, over the last week or so. And one of the things has just been like so... exciting to me as a former scientist who is traumatized by the experience is the idea that science could be done differently. And you know, kind of as Abby was getting at, and this, like, you know, I also highlighted this care for science question. And I actually kind of want to comment the same thing, but from the perspective of young scientists and engineers. I mean, my students is kind of who I'm putting into this equation, but, you know, whoever you want to imagine, you know, I've got all these students who, you know, they have these values, these feminist, anti-colonial, anti-racist, all of these like great values that they really want to enact in the world. But then they're going to like go into labs and engineering firms and be asked to like build bombs and whatever. They're going to be asked to basically just reproduce colonialism. And there's something like so exciting to me about this, the promise you offer that science could be different. You know, this, and this promise, and I like the way you said it, and you had said this in a podcast also, so I was picking up on it, this idea that there's no monolithic science. And so I kind of want to see if you have any thoughts just on, you know, for those who don't have like a lab to like to kind of build out these like alternative spaces within science, I want to ask like how else you've seen, or how else people try, or if you have any other strategies for like changing the practices of science, you know, from the perspective of like a young scientist.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of things I want to say, and I hope I remember at least 50% of them. So whenever I talk to anyone about change work, I think we always start with two ideas, jurisdiction and scale, or what I call jurisdiction and scale. So the first is that you always have some jurisdiction within your control, even if you're an undergraduate science student, and then also if you're like president of the world, right? They're very different jurisdictions, but you always have a jurisdiction, your own household, your own room, your own assignments, your own hands, your own, right? You have some jurisdiction, even if it's limited. And I think one of the problems, especially, well, lots of people fall into, is this idea of scale having to always be big. But this is why I talk about scale a lot in the book as the relationships that matter. So like one of the examples in the book is like, okay, everyone's got gravity, and that's a relationship and a scale that really matters to an elephant, but to a virus, gravity doesn't really matter. I mean, it's still there, but it doesn't really matter. And so within your jurisdiction, what are the relations that matter, and how can you intervene into those relations? So there's one student in my lab who's, I don't know what kind of student he is. He's somewhere between an advanced undergraduate and a graduate student. He might be an intern or co-op student, which is why I don't know. But anyway, he's working with all these other scientists on these fish papers, and they keep calling fish biomass. And he just goes up behind them and edits them all and turns all that biomass back into fish. That's his main contributions to the editing process, is just to call the fish, fish. And when they put, you know, there's a rotifer, and they're dignified, you know, throughout the paper, they're like rotifer or R. And then they just talk about Rs for the rest of the paper, rotifer, a type of plankton. And he just goes back and be like, actually, their name is rotifer. And he'll just, so just these little, because he's in charge of editing and making sure all the scientific names are right and making sure all the periods are there. And so he, and it doesn't look wrong. It's just expanding and clarifying, right? But that he's like, fish are fucking people, like fish are people too. And so he'll put the fish back in instead of calling them biomass, calling them whatever, calling them R, calling, right? And that's jurisdiction. And that's a relationship that matters. And that's what he does, because that's kind of the one of the greatest scales in his jurisdiction. So I feel like there's always these things. Yeah. They don't have to change the world or change the system. They just have to impact the relationships that matter and meet your obligations within the jurisdiction that you have. Cause we're all in different places in the system, right?
That was a really beautiful answer. Thank you so much. Yeah. I'll hand it back to Abby.
Thanks. I wanted to comment on your citational practices, which you introduced at the beginning of your talk, but I think that maybe people who haven't read your book yet might, or haven't, you know, read some of the other writings that you've done might not be familiar with. And so I wanted to give you a little chance to talk about some of those choices that you've made and why they're so important. I know that I really loved all of your footnotes in the book, and, you know, I probably spent more time absorbing your footnotes than reading the main body of the text sometimes, because there's just so much, not only information and explanation, but also expressions of love and frustration and like connections with people in your footnotes as well. And then related to that, I just wanted to share that I learned a lot from things that you've written about author order and sort of thinking about collaboration, which is another way of, you know, naming the people who have contributed to a project. So those things have been really important to me, and I bet they would be important to other people here if they heard a little bit more about them. So maybe you could share just a little bit about that, about that work you've been doing.
So, I mean, citational politics are a huge, huge area, and there's lots of people doing lots of work in it. Core to that, and I'm going to try to answer this a long time so we don't have to deal with Jess's question in the chat, which is a super hard question. Jess always asks hard questions. So one of the issues with dominant science is that it erases other forms of knowledge, or makes it subservient, or makes it a resource for Western science. And this is super common, and actually, colonialism depends on being able to suck up local knowledge, digest it, rob it, and then use it against local people, right, in various ways. And so being really attentive to attribution, and especially attribution to knowledge from places like Twitter, where there's a lot of Indigenous people doing public intellectualism, saying thank you to all the sorts of people who are doing all of this work of, like, just, I mean, how many papers, like, so Tuck and Yang sometimes talk about, like, oh, we had to write decolonization is not a metaphor because we were getting super annoyed, right? They had better things to do. Patricia Nash had better things to do than to talk about the defense of, you know, intersectionality, but they put all this work into it as a, just, you know, to put the signpost there so they could just, you know, and like, thank you for doing that labor, which totally sucked. And I know you had better things to do. And so that takes a special sort of thank you and a special sort of citation. There's this concept in Michif called Peyotuk, which is erroneously often translated into English as be careful, as in like something's dangerous, be careful, that's sharp, be careful. But the more the way it's been explained to me in Michif and Cree is that it actually means something more like, when you walk, you put down medicine, you're also walking in other people's medicine, like these fraught terrains, there's no terra nullis, there's like medicine all over the frickin' place. So be careful how you walk, because you're leaving it for other people, and be careful what's in front of you, because they're, you know, and so that's what care looks like, this sort of all of this walking piled up on top of each other. And so that's how I try and do my citational practices, right? Just leaving it lots all over the place for people coming behind me and acknowledging that, you know, there's people who came before me and there's shoulders I stand on. And so as a methodologist, I try and make that work super explicit, as opposed to sticking in the bibliography or something. I try and get it to rise up on the page and interrupt my conversation to make it not sound like I'm just monologuing cleanly, but you know, yeah. So that's a little bit of it. And I was talking to Kathy earlier People are like, oh my gosh, how do you get your ideas for the footnote? I'm like, Karl Marx, the white guys, it's an indigenous methodology. Like Karl Marx has the best footnotes in like Capital. They're half the page and all his jokes are in the footnotes, right? And even though people don't always recognize his jokes because they're super dry and geeky. I was just like, well, I'm gonna do like Karl Marx did.
I love that. Thank you so much. I think I was going to ask another question, maybe about plastics. Can we bring plastics into the discussion today?
Yes, I was going to bring plastics in. I was going to do it by way of purity politics. So, you know, your work is so focused on plastics. And you mentioned in the talk, or you were really pushing back on this idea of purity politics in your talk. And I really love that kind of that reframing. And that's one of the things that's so exciting to me about the framework of ruderal ecology, the idea that we're not inhabiting a world where purity is even possible or desirable or you know, it's not on the table. And also in the spirit of pushing back on purity politics, I really didn't plan this question out very well in advance, so it's just not gonna flow well, so sorry. I mean, basically I wanna ask, you know, how is the approach of Clear Lab, how is this kind of, you know, anti-colonial, anti-purity politics approach to plastics. It sort of recognizes the way that plastics are always already in everything and there is very little control on the part of the average consumer over plastics. How has that shaped your, or how can that reshape our, the people just in this room, our relationships with plastics as consumers, as activists, as citizens, as artists, as whatever?
The same way as climate change.
Okay, I'll just
do
that.
The world's shortest version. So plastics and climate change have something in common, and that's petrochemical. Both the extraction, the companies that extract oil and produce crude oil are the same companies that the primary companies that create the feedstock for plastics. And it's just secondary manufacturers who take that and turn them into plastics. So they're the same places, the same lobbies, the same laws. If you end subsidies to oil, you also end subsidies to plastic. And increasingly with renewable energy coming, becoming more important and more central, the oil and gas industry is turning to plastics as the thing that will make up that market deficit for them. So it is actually in many ways the same problem. Also like climate change, it's a global problem with massively different local manifestations. Also like climate change, it's really hard to deal with the global scale. And you could argue that you cannot argue with a global scale. And so again, there's a jurisdictional issue about, okay, what are the relationships that matter? Are they political? Are they, you know, business? Are they, you know, financial? Or, you know, and how do we put pressure on those relationships that matter? So the good news is you can use the climate change playbook, which is pretty well developed at this point.
That was Dr. Max Libiron, our headlining speaker at the Sanctuary for Independent Media's Ruderal Ecologies 2 conference from October. You can hear Hudson Mohawk Magazine's interview with Dr. Libiron, as well as links to more recordings from the conference and interviews with all the speakers at mediasanctuary.org. That's it for today's episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Until next time!